Thanks for downloading the talk show from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
This is the talk show on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If built as proposed, the Trans-Texas Corridor will propel the term superhighway to an unprecedented new level. The 600-mile stretch through this state would be part of a 50-year, $184 billion transportation network that would link the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. When complete, the entire project would be an estimated 1,200 feet wide and 4,000 miles long, with designated lanes for cars, trucks and trains, energy and water pipelines, and conduits for utility and broadband cables. The Texas portion is expected to run roughly parallel to I-35 from Laredo to Gainesville. The state has accepted a proposal to build it as a toll road using private funds. Construction is slated to begin as early as 2010, but a lot remains undecided and controversial. Supporters say the plan will relieve congestion on the already strained I-35 without significant tax spending and secure Texas's place as a premier U.S. hub for transportation of international trade goods. Opponents have voiced a litany of concerns for the rights of private property owners along the route, as well as the welfare of towns and businesses bypassed by it. Other detractors worry the Trans-Texas Corridor will serve as an unintentional pipeline for illegal immigrants, while still others are suspicious of a domestic project left in the hands of a consortium that includes a foreign-owned company. With much still to be decided, the Texas Department of Transportation has scheduled 54 hearings throughout the state on the matter. The final one set for North Texas takes place tomorrow night at the Grawweiler Center in Dallas. In preparation for that, we have two guests today who can help articulate the vastly different viewpoints on the project. Linda Stahl is a co-founder of CorridorWatch.org, a grassroots group that opposes the Trans-Texas Corridor project as it has been proposed. Michael Morris is director of transportation for the North Central Texas Council of Governments. He has worked with regional officials not to defeat the TTC, but to create a revised route plan that would reportedly save close to $2 billion and 60 miles of construction. Welcome to both of you to the talk show.
Chris, good afternoon.
Michael, what are the realities of infrastructure for transportation in North Texas right now, and what are the predictions for the next several decades?
Well, on the supply side, we have a large shortage of transportation funds, and constraints breed innovation, and here we are trying to bring private sector partners to the table. In this case, we're trying to integrate both within region routes and intercity routes. On the demand side, you know, we're a fast-growing region. We add 1 million people every 7 years. There's going to be 4 million people moving to this corridor in the next 10 years. So I think the government, you know, from the governor's office to TxDOT, should be complimented in raising the awareness of this particular need.
Now, in terms of what that would do, the population growth, say, to the traffic on I-35, you hear more people, you assume more congestion, but what do you think about the number of vehicles and that sort of thing on the existing I-35 if nothing else is added?
Well, we all saw the pictures from Katrina, and we're not going to say that's a typical travel day in the future, but we have a population of Texas that basically is disappointed in government's ability to provide better service. We hear every day that the four-lane section of Interstate 35 is not adequate. Those that travel both north to Oklahoma and south towards Austin from our region realize the age of that particular infrastructure. The state very much understands that the status quo is not an acceptable solution. And I think it's up to your listeners, these TxDOT public meetings, Linda's views, to come up with a strategy that implements what's in the best interest of the citizens of Texas.
Linda, I know that you and your colleagues have acknowledged that the state is growing, but you have some challenges to the assumptions about exactly how it will grow and how infrastructure needs will grow.
Well, yes. And the goal of Corridor Watch has always been to educate and inform. When David and I first learned about the Trans-Texas Corridor project, it was early in 2002, and we were very surprised at the scope and the scale. But I was assured by my state representative that all of the legislative needs in the plan would not be met and that it probably would not move forward as it was described. But when House Bill 3588 passed in 2003, all of those legislative needs were met, and TxDOT had one public hearing in every county in February of 2004. They had 254 public hearings in 28 days. And our feeling was that was not adequate opportunity for the public to comment, let alone to learn about such a broad project. We're very, very concerned that entities like North Central Texas COG has not been included in the planning process, that the project came out of the governor's office. It was his idea of innovative thinking. I don't know, roads and rail have been around for 100 years. I don't know how innovative that really is. But we were concerned that the unique regions of Texas with their special needs, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex is a very unique entity, separate and distinct from San Antonio and Houston and Austin, and that the fact that they were not included in the planning process is a serious flaw, and we really believe that a flawed process has resulted in a flawed project.
Now, the planning certainly isn't over. Michael, talk about what you see as the potential benefits, at least to this part of Texas, if this goes forward as proposed now.
Well, I think the listeners probably have a pretty good understanding in this part of the state. A region like ours historically should have never occurred. We're the largest inland metropolitan area in the United States that doesn't have access to a seaport. So for us, transportation is our lifeblood. If you look at it historically, we've had three major events: the railroads coming in the 1800s, the interstate highway system, which is celebrating its 50th year anniversary, the creation of DFW Airport, and I suggest this Trans-Texas Corridor vision is our generation's major transportation commitment to the Dallas-Fort Worth region. And the backbone of it is taking trucks off the interstate highway and more efficiently putting them on rail, creating a comprehensive corridor that includes utilities. We got an aging pipeline system where you hear about explosions of that system. We've had a hot summer, and we continue to need water, and this is the backbone system of making sure we have water in the future. People have been upset about their electric rates. One of the reasons they're so high is we don't have enough transmission capacity delivering electricity to our region. At some point in the future, high-speed rail will be in the backbone of the area. We have to rebuild a aging infrastructure, so we need roadway access heading to and from the south. We need greater railroad capacity integrated with moving these trucks off of trucks into rail. So what you have for Dallas-Fort Worth region is the continued need for transportation accessibility. The other thing the Dallas-Fort Worth region needs is to continue to be at the crossroads of north-south international travel and east-west international travel. And the Trans-Texas Corridor in our region serves both this north-south need as well as this east-west need. The largest freight rail bottleneck in the country is in the Dallas-Fort Worth region at Tower 55. We have trains queuing up for 90 minutes at a time. It has air quality implications. Trucks hog roadway capacity that we need for commuters. Trucks are very high in emissions, and we're desperately trying to come into attainment of the standard. So it's these 10 or 12 items all aligning themselves very nicely into where the Dallas-Fort Worth region needs to proceed.
Let's talk a little bit about the route before we go any further, because I know there are a couple of different ideas. The one that is sort of officially in existence right now, it's a little bit tough to do this on the radio without a map, but looks like sort of a pair of bowed legs. And then the proposal that you're looking at is a little more like a lollipop on a stick. If you want to, can you explain that a little bit better than I just did?
Well, it's important to point out that donut you're talking about goes to the south and continues to the north. The point of the state's interest here is one of intercity, transportation between cities. And as a part of our, quote, United States, they have to deal with a national transportation system and international crossings. I think the beauty of our particular concept, and I think, you know, it'd be interesting to hear Linda's comment because I think she would probably agree, we think it's critical that this intercity transportation system have tremendous close proximity to the urban regions. And this donut that you're talking about that continues to the north is actually within the Dallas-Fort Worth region. And it's important for the public to understand that this transportation system would look very different than the rest of the ones we're building, because in this case, the trucks would be in dedicated lanes in the median where we separate the trucks from the cars, where on the LBJ corridors and others, it's the commuters that have the priority in the middle express lanes. And we think there's a win-win that the new loop around the Dallas-Fort Worth region which would meet our within-region travel on the outsides of the corridor, could also meet the intercity needs of providing the trucks and the express lanes in the middle of the corridor. And remember, you know, the original vision was we had to put all these modes in the same 1,200-foot strip. You know, more recent conversation is, well, why don't we put the best mode in the best part of the corridor, and we may have parallel corridors meeting all of these particular needs. So existing freight railroad tracks can be better utilized as part of this particular vision and be parallel to the corridor as well. So if we think it lines up around State Highway 360, if you're familiar with the region, which is halfway between the two regions, it comes out from the south, tucked in, we hope, very closely to Austin and West and Hillsboro. And then when it gets south of the region, there's a new region, south of Midlothian, there's a new regional lollipop route, big circle that goes around the region, and then it continues up the Interstate 35 corridor to the north. And we think it's a win-win in that it is more sustainable. It is not a regional route 20, 30 miles to our east. I think the criticism of some of the rural interest can be met. I don't think the route should be built in places where people aren't interested in it. Our region is very interested in it. And we think we can more surgically put the right mode in the right corridor by integrating it into this vision that we're trying to work with TxDOT on. And I think we've made a lot of progress in the last few months with regard to these public comments.
Linda, if that route were approved by the state, would that be enough to ameliorate your concerns?
Well, it would certainly be a step in the right direction. I have heard about this plan, and Mike presented it to the Trans-Texas Corridor Advisory Committee, which I serve on, and I was glad to see that they had a plan that would work for their community, and they were having an opportunity to present that and get some sort of reaction from the commission that might be positive. One of our earliest concerns about the project was the incredible land consumption. This is private property, and each linear mile of the corridor as proposed, with it being 1,200 feet wide, takes 146 acres per mile. And since those two bowed legs that you describe as it approaches the Metroplex, that is not two halves of a whole. That is an either or. One is a preferred and one is a less preferred alternative. So it will not be both of those creating a road system around the Metroplex. And all of that acreage being taken out of rural Texas, because the original plan, as Mike pointed out, didn't really show this linking the cities. So what we saw was an enormous transportation project that didn't go to any of our major cities, went from where nobody lives to where nobody works, and it didn't seem to suit anybody's needs. And we have said right from the beginning that this doesn't meet the congestion in urban cities, the traffic problems in urban cities, and it creates problems in rural Texas. It's a designated hazmat route. It is a toll route. It will have limited access. So when you come through small communities with hazardous materials, for example, the presumption is that they will serve that with emergency services. Well, this provides a huge burden to those communities to have to serve, provide that service. They don't have the budget. They don't have the training. Small communities. Closed access means people are not getting off the tollway to come into the communities and have lunch and visit the squares. You know, a lot of these small towns have invested an awful lot of money in development of their charming courthouse squares, and their economic viability depends on tourism. And the road will have traveler services within it. So it's a definitely a throughway.
What makes it worse than, say, the interstate system, which also sort of bypasses a lot of small towns?
Well, interestingly enough, when the interstate system was first proposed in the 50s, it was proposed as a tollway, and it was proposed not connecting major cities. But there was a lot of discussion, and city leaders asked that it be considered a freeway and that it connects cities, and that's why we have the freeways we have today.
Okay, we will take a quick break and come back for our discussion with Michael Morris of the North Central Texas Council of Governments and Linda Stahl of CorridorWatch.org of the Trans-Texas Corridor. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or email talkshow@kera.org. This is the talk show on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests today are Linda Stahl of CorridorWatch.org, a group that opposes the current proposal for the Trans-Texas Corridor, and Michael Morris, who is with the North Central Texas Council of Governments. He is head of transportation for them. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email talkshow at KERA.org. The first emails we have in are still basically sort of questions about understanding exactly how this is going to work. Tony asks, is the rail portion envisioned primarily as a freight line or as a passenger line, or will there be both?
Well, Tony asks a very good question. It is envisioned that it has both forms of rail, both freight and passenger rail. We think we have an immediate east-west rail problem, which is part of this particular package, where those of you who are in the western side of the region, Tower 55 is underneath the 35W Interstate 30 interchange. But we're also looking at, and this is our generation's statement to say, at some point in the future, I don't think it's in the next 10 or 15 years, we need to leave the right-of-way for passenger rail, high-speed passenger rail service, because Dallas-Fort Worth will be 8 or 9 million people, Houston will be about the same, the San Antonio-Austin, I don't know, Linda may know, maybe 4 or 5 million people. More productive technologies will continue over time, and I think we should leave contingency for this high-speed rail. So Tony asked a good question. Both rail modes are included in this particular vision.
And that's one of the problems with the whole one-size-fits-all of the Trans-Texas Corridor plan. In order to anticipate needs like that in the future, the Transportation Commission has said it's necessary to establish the entire footprint at the beginning. And that means taking a tremendous amount of private property and holding it until maybe or maybe not the technology is in place or the high-speed rail is necessary or those demands exist.
Now, the state said they would lease back the land that they plan to use to the sort of current owners who would become occupants, I guess, leasing from the state.
Yes, and the first time I had a long conversation with my state representative in my community, he said, Linda, what's your biggest fear? And I said, my biggest fear is that the state comes through to do this project. They take my house because that's what's necessary to establish the footprint. And it turns out they never really need that section of it to develop. And I lease it back, and now the state is my landlord. And, you know, I've only lived in my house for about 5 years, and having the state be my landlord, well, I could probably move somewhere else. But for people who have ranched and farmed their land for multiple generations, I mean, we honor our century farmers in this state. The Ag Commissioner gives proclamations and awards to people who have held their land and ranched it and farmed it for over 100 years. And for those people, losing their land is losing their livelihood. This is not moving your house or moving a gas station two blocks over to take advantage of new construction, new freeway construction. This is losing your livelihood. So I don't really think that the multi-generational rancher farmer is interested in having the state of Texas be their landlord simply because they can obtain the land now for cheaper. They're kind of punishing them for doing something that doesn't have the same cash value as another business.
Do you have any response to
that,
Michael?
Yeah, Chris, if I could just add, you know, we can point to 100 corridors within the Dallas-Fort Worth region, none of them which have enough right-of-way. And I think the generation before us, I don't want to be too critical of them. Sometimes they took the easy way out, and it was easier to deal with a very contested transportation project and say, oh, we only need 200 feet of right-of-way, and we go build what we know in the long run is too small a facility. I think the governor and TxDOT need to be given credit when they said, you know what, this isn't going to be a popular decision, but everyone before us has taken the easy way out with regard to this particular question. If we're really going to serve the citizens of this region in the next 50 or 100 years, someone has to stand up and say, we need a right-of-way that isn't done incrementally. You know, mm-hmm. You build it, and then everyone moves in, and then those people are bought out, and it's widened, and then everyone moves in. I mean, that's not good government either. The second thing, and I think it's important to point out, yes, we need to protect, you know, individual home and land rights, especially in this state that has such a strong history of individual land ownership. It's very important. But let's change gears 180 degrees now. China is becoming an international power. The United States is going to survive if it can continue to compete with China in a world economy. The balance of trade is devastating. We don't mind buying Nike sneakers made in China for $17. if the United States is going to continue to be a national presence 50, 100, 200, 300 years into the future, it's going to have to reinvest into a national transportation system. So TxDOT is standing up and saying, look, we're part of a United States that has to build a north-south and an east-west transportation system. We're at the crossroads of this country. And someone has to stand up and say the difficult things. And I don't think the first response should always be, let's pound on the people that are taking a leadership position for both what's in the best interest of the state and the nation.
Well, I think it's important also just for your listeners to visualize the Trans-Texas Corridor as it's described in the plan is 1,200 feet wide. An average interstate, you know, right-of-way to right-of-way is 350 feet. So this is substantially greater. But I don't disagree entirely with what Mr. Morris has to say. I think it is true that you do have to look ahead and you do need a little bit more than just the minimum, and it is tough to make those decisions. No road project is going to be popular. Even the red line that NCTCOG has presented, I know I've talked to people who live in the counties south of the Metroplex who are going to say, oh, that's terrible too. But I feel a lot better about it being a project that comes from years of regional transportation planning rather than a political motivation. I think it is a political drive that motivates this project. I did not come out of TxDOT originally. It wasn't originated with any of our transportation education institutes. And I feel a lot better about a project that is approved or promoted by regional planners who are accountable to their communities than a plan that comes just out of Austin.
Briefly, what happens to mineral rights on land that is taken by eminent domain? Has that been established?
My understanding, and I've heard this from several different sources, is that the state of Texas does not take the minerals, that the minerals stay with the original owner. In Texas, you can separate your minerals from your surface rights and that the state is not involved. Although water is an increasingly big issue and sort of water is the new oil. And I think that your listeners may also be a little bit concerned that it might not be water coming into the Dallas area, but it could be water going out of the Dallas area. And that the corridor provides an easement, whereas in the past it was not cost effective to move water around the state because it was very expensive to obtain all of the easements necessary, that the Trans-Texas Corridor provides an access to a nicely, neatly created easement across the state. I-35 is just one route of the Trans-Texas Corridor proposal. I-69 follows behind, and then there's an I-10 route. And that's a little bit unnerving to rural farmers who depend on groundwater to think that the Trans-Texas Corridor might be used not for a roadway. In fact, that out towards El Paso, you might never see any concrete at all, but you might see water pipelines moving the water around the state, and that changes the picture a little bit.
I guess it depends if you need water or if the water's going
away
from
water.
You. I can see how that would definitely be amended. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones and talk to Jeff in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeff.
Yes. Two questions. The contract concerning the private contractor from Spain, my understanding is that this has not been revealed to the public. And when I went to the Fort Worth hearings, I was staggered by a couple of things in this regard. First of all, the size of this is huge. My understanding is $184 billion. Secondly, in TxDOT's film that preceded the meeting, they said rail could be introduced. That was the extent of it. It sounded like it was largely a toll road project, and to be honest, it just smells like a rat. So I guess my big question is a contract, but secondly, the other thing with regard to the farmland and commuting back and forth to Austin, I noticed to the west is more like ranch land. I would guess there's probably less crops grown, and it just seems at some point in time as we develop, if we're going to think about the future, we need to be concerned with that. And certainly it's more hilly, but if you get further out towards 281, I think you encounter flatter lands that are more conducive to this kind of development.
Well, Jeff, I think you raised about six issues, but let's see if we can get some comments for you. Thanks for your call.
Jeff is right. The elements, and I'll try to be really clear about this because it can be confusing, elements of the Comprehensive Development Agreement that TxDOT has signed with Cintra have not been released. And one of the key elements is the financial section. And in fact, the Houston Chronicle requested, through an open records request, that section and the other section that hasn't been released as well, the implementation, and that was declined. And they requested an attorney general's opinion, and the attorney general said it should be released. And Cintra has filed a suit to block that, and TxDOT has joined in. And I've attended a lot of hearings in the area and in the broader area, and I would say that is one of the significant concerns of Corridor Watch members and citizens who are attending the hearings, that they can't really make a good assessment of the project. They can't give good feedback to TxDOT when they don't have all the information.
Michael, do you suspect that the contract contains things that people would be very upset to read?
Well, I think Jeff brings up a very good point. You know, I've worked my whole life in government, and I think government can be more productive than a private sector entity, but it has to be more opened. In this particular case, and I think this is an issue, you know, where TxDOT is very aware of the particular issue, the legislature is very aware of the issue. In the case of working with the private sector, no different than maybe where Jeff works or someone else in the region, when the private sector competes, there are parts that are open to the public, which are in public interest, and there are parts of a particular contract that are proprietary, that have intellectual property that that private sector company wishes to retain. There are portions of this particular corridor that still can go to other private sector companies. And what Cintra Zachary is trying to do is to protect their intellectual property or their innovation that they're bringing to the particular corridor so other competitors of theirs don't get that for free or no cost. So it's an issue that TxDOT's aware of. They're sorting it out. Jeff and Linda should have an expectation that that is all openly aired. That is TxDOT's interest. They just have to find the right mechanism and the right time to do that. So that's a procurement question. I also think Jeff brings up a good point about the land. One of the things that's really surprised me, since I wake up every day trying to build multimodal transportation projects within the Dallas-Fort Worth region, and I'm not an expert on rural interest, since we're going to be moving a whole bunch of water in this particular corridor, and now reminded by these hot temperatures, it's always surprised me, and maybe, Linda, you can give me some insight, how come the rural parts of the state haven't tried to develop a partnership with TxDOT to try to get access to the water that's going to be moved up in the, up and down this particular corridor and use this as an opportunity to develop a more economic rural program? Because I see all the time agricultural interest in our region. Mm-hmm. Cattle farmers suffer from moving their herd large distances because of droughts. Here's an opportunity where the agricultural interest, instead of just saying, well, gee, this is horrible,
Right. There's
water going to be in this particular corridor. This is the gold of this century. Is there not a partnership that could be driven to help meet the rural interest in the same corridor?
Well, that's a very good observation. And I think that brings us to the subject of inclusiveness. And by the same token that NCTCOG has not been included in this planning process, I would project that maybe the rural counties have not been included. And that is something that TxDOT needs to look at. I know, again, we come back to the political issue. Is TxDOT, is the Transportation Commission really reaching out to the communities, both the urban centers for their training, their planning expertise, and to the rural community to see what it is that they truly need?
There does come a point, though, where everyone has an interest, and you may want it here because you own a 7-Eleven and it's going to bring traffic, and mm-hmm. Somebody else may want something there. At what point does it become sort of, after the input has been made, someone has to really make the final decision and make a decision that no matter what is the ultimate plan, some people will be very unhappy with and negatively affected by?
Well, we do have a process. I mean, we do have a democratic process in our state, and there are an awful lot of people who are given and accept the responsibility to make decisions. That's what we call elected officials, and the people they make decisions for are called their constituents. And from the county judge to the regional transportation planning to the Metropolitan Planning Organization to your state legislator, they are all people that you have sent off to help make those decisions for you, because obviously those people have information that we will never have in our day-to-day lives and probably aren't that interested in. And yes, of course, that's why I hesitate to say, oh, yes, the red line is perfect, because there is always going to be somebody that is negatively impacted. And it is heart-wrenching. And I know that TxDOT feels bad when they hear people come and say how hard it is for them to lose their family farm. Somebody does have to make those tough decisions. However, there has not been enough inclusion on this process.
Talking about the Trans-Texas Corridor with Linda Stahl from CorridorWatch.org and Michael Morris from the North Central Texas Council of Governments, let's talk to Sandy in Dallas. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. In doing all of this research on this corridor, since part of it starts at Laredo, has anyone examined the increased drug trafficking that may be brought into our state, and as well as any illegal aliens and immigrants and things like that? But I'm really interested in seeing if anyone has examined that or looked at that.
Well, when I'm not absolutely certain about something, I fall back on the law. And I think that border issues and immigration are certainly a hot topic right now. And there are an awful lot of people who are focusing on what our current laws are and how to best enforce them at the border. I know there's a lot of concern that this will open up the border more. That is not a concern that I endorse necessarily. I think that we still have an immigration point between the United States and Mexico, and that it will continue to be enforced as best it possibly can.
Yes, Sandy, I'm in Linda's court on this, too. In fact, I'm not convinced this isn't going to be a great benefit. There are 24 federal agencies that deal with issues that cross the border, from drugs to agricultural products. In this particular case, what you're seeing is the first time that products will be locked within a particular country, let's say Mexico, and that either train car or truck is pre-routed to someplace in the United States. And if that truck or rail car stays on its pre-assigned routes, all the taxes, all the expenses, all the weigh-in motion that occurs, and if that truck goes to Detroit or Chicago or Montreal and it behaves how it is supposed to, then there is ease of inspection and goods can be moved up 50% in their scheduling across the country because they don't have to constantly get re-inspected. Here is a place where we can take this century's technology and put it on this century's transportation system, and I think it's going to create better enforcement because you're going to have more seamless connections across the particular borders. When a Treasury agent shuts a rail car or shuts a truck and has inspected those products for all 24 functional interests of the U.S. government, then I think we're increasing the security of the particular nation. What we have right now isn't a very secured situation, and here's an opportunity that if you really believe in these items, to get involved and integrate it into this new vision.
We'll take a quick break and resume our discussion of the Trans-Texas Corridor. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to talkshow@kera.org. Tomorrow on the talk show, what are the chances the U.S. will suffer a terrorist attack this year? Are public fears justified, or are they fueled by media hype that just doesn't bear up to serious scrutiny? Jeff Whittington compares the myths of the war on terror to its realities with the senior editor of Foreign Policy magazine and the vice president for national security at the Center for American Progress. You can go to the talk show page of KERA.org for schedules and links to more information. You can also sign up for our free daily podcast. Returning now to our discussion of the Trans-Texas Corridor. You can join that discussion at 1-800-933-5372 or email talkshow@kera.org. That's what Joe did in Dallas. He asks, doesn't this entire project conflict with the nation's movement away from petroleum fuels? A huge highway, in my opinion, really encourages more individual travel. What do you say to that?
Well, we already have a pretty built-in inefficiency. I think too much of the international goods are being moved by truck. It's a very inefficient mode. Freight companies' largest customer are trucks. I don't think building additional road bridges across the Rio Grande is the right answer. I think building more freight train bridges. This plan envisions moving more efficiently commodities more on rail than on truck. There also is this notion that we're going to create a green corridor. What I mean by that is, why can't we establish in the same corridor across this whole country, new fuel technologies. The worst fuel we can be propelling both trucks and freight trains is diesel fuel, both in particulates and nitrogen oxides. Why can't we develop more fuel-efficient corridors and start having literally a pipeline of fuel delivering new technologies across this corridor?
Well, one thing I would say about that is some of those new technologies and fuels seem to involve corn, and I know that the corn farmers here in Texas are worried that we're paving their farmland. One of the problems with the Trans-Texas Corridor is it is a toll road, and so for motorists, they're looking at increased fuel cost, fuel tax, and now a toll on top of that. And when you charge somebody something, it's a tax. So the toll, it's almost a double taxation, the toll on top of the fuel tax that we already pay. And that's a concern for a lot of the motorists that I talk to, and that we are limiting ourselves to an outmoded form of transportation, and that it is a burden on those communities to bear that. And if we could go back to the truck issue for just a minute, one of the concerns that I hear a lot at Corridor Watch is the fact that this is a designated hazmat route, that these are heavier trucks running at higher speeds, and in a closed corridor, an accident could cause, first, a huge bottleneck, could impact a rural area ill-equipped to handle it. And I've also heard TxDOT promote this as a potential evacuation route. And as somebody who evacuated Rita, my daughter lives in a coastal community with my granddaughter, and I went and picked them up and ferried them out of the Clear Lake area. We spent 24 hours on the road, and my biggest fear was when we got to the Katy Freeway area and we were going to be on an elevated closed portion that we were almost out of gas and we had no water. And all I wanted to do was get off that road and get into a community where there were people. And we ended up making the rest of our trip through rural Texas back to our home in Fayette County. And I am concerned that a corridor like this is very vulnerable to that kind of problem, people being stuck within it and services not being available, and potential bottlenecks for rail and for passengers.
What about the issue of going around it in communities where it does pass through? What has the state promised about our ability to sort of get across it perpendicular?
Well, clearly in this is both the ability of going in our region, both north, south, and east, west. So our plan envisions seamless connections in both directions. I think we got to be very careful that in the rural portions, you don't want to provide too much access, because you're going to have huge leapfrog developments that occur where lower-priced land, you know, 30 or 40 miles away becomes the new town. And I think we got to be very careful that that doesn't undermine what it is we're trying to do. I like the caller's question, and your question. Let's focus on this gas tax just for a minute. If we were to survey the people that were coming up in the hurricane evacuation and said, 24 hours is a long time, would you have been willing to pay a toll in order to get to your destination a little faster? I think it would have been a somewhat close to a unanimous decision. The other thing we got to remember is, with new technologies on fuel, we're 20 years away from not even having fuel taxes, because as new technologies come out where they don't use fuel, electric, hybrid vehicles, hydrogen vehicles, we're going to have to move towards another method to fund our transportation needs. So this notion of tolling is the new technology, not the old technology. In the next 20 years, you will see technologies that no longer make the taxing of fuel a legitimate and sustainable revenue source for transportation, because large shares of the market won't be using fuel.
Now, there was a privately built toll road from Laredo that was supposed to connect the border that was really a failure and continues to. Finally, the state bought it out. It was built for $90 million. The state bought it for $12 million after an auction and a sale. It's still not generating enough tax revenue to even pay for maintenance. What can we learn from that project, and how is that substantially different from this much longer toll privately run project?
Two things. On the public sector side, which have very conservative estimates of toll, at least the ones that are being built in the region, it is not surprising that toll road revenue is 30-40% ahead of projections, because when you go to Wall Street to borrow money, you don't want to be in that particular situation. These people that lend you money for roadways want to see conservative assumptions. The beauty on the private sector side is the risk of building the roadways to the private sector vendor. It's the private sector due diligence that will determine their interest in building the particular road. And on failure to operate the particular road, 100% of those assets are returned back to the public sector at little or no cost. The beauty of this particular proposition is, if you're scared about the revenue necessary to generate the particular project, we think in government we should determine when it's in our public sector interest to sell bonds to build it, And when it's in our private sector interest and in inner city transportation, we think it may be in the public sector interest that if there's a private sector interest that is not exposing the public sector and is willing to take this particular risk, and on their failure, they revert these assets to the public. Remember, the state owns the right-of-way. There's lots of people that say, you know, foreign countries are going to take over our land. Texas homeowners and Texas taxpayers and Texas residents are the owners of that particular property. The state is just leasing that to a particular company. And like most leases, if that 7-Eleven goes out of business or something else goes out of business, that business reverts back to the owner of that particular property.
Well, realistically, there is a problem if a project midway it stops because of a bankruptcy. Whenever a road project is midway and the builder of it, the contractor of it, goes into bankruptcy or is stalled because of financial problems, that creates a huge inconvenience. And if it is a necessary road project, then it would be incumbent on the state to finish it. So the taxpayer would be involved. But we do realize it is state land. But coming back to the financial aspect of it and coming back to the issue of not releasing the financial section because of proprietary information, I think when you play ball with a state project that the rules should be a little bit different, and maybe you can't be quite so proprietary about some of your financial information. They are using the state's right of eminent domain to obtain the land to build their project. I've heard a lot of people say, if it's such a great investment, then let them pay fair market value directly to the property owner. But they are going to go into partnership with the state. They are going to use the power of eminent domain. It is a different issue altogether, and it would be very inconvenient for all of us if it doesn't get completed.
Let's talk to Gary in Emeta South. Hi, Gary. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Pardon?
Go ahead, please.
I'm mayor of a small town in Parker County, and I'm very familiar with the infrastructure, rail and so forth, the autobahns all over Europe. And what we have here is we've got a lady I'm not criticizing her particularly, but the viewpoint she expressed was that we should be suspicious of this project because it came out of TxDOT. It seems to me that TxDOT has, for instance, built 50 electronic billboards around Fort Worth that cost $100,000 apiece, and have done very little planning. Our North Corridor out of Dallas is forever choked up. The Austin-Fort Worth Corridor is forever choked up. They've done very little real planning, so it's good to have planning come from somewhere else. The source shouldn't be the issue. The merits of the project should be the issue. And if it's too big, if it's too wide, that's something that can be discussed. But the fact that there's a need for a corridor that moves rail and takes some of our trucking and puts it on rail and takes some of the trucking and separates it from cars, I think is a very worthwhile goal, and it's going to take a long time to do. And sure, there needs to be lots of input, but let's not kill it because of where the idea came from.
Gary, thanks so much for your perspective. I appreciate it.
Well, I think it begs the question, when is the Trans-Texas Corridor not the Trans-Texas Corridor? I mean, as proposed, it's 1,200 foot wide and includes all of these various elements. And I agree there needs to be more discussion. As a matter of fact, that has been one of our issues from the very beginning, that there has not been enough discussion, that the input from people like NCTCOG has not been included. I mean, Mr. Morris is wearing a necktie today, and if I tell Mr. Morris, gee, I really like your tie, but, you know, I don't really like stripes, and I wish it had a print, and I don't really like blue. I wish it was red, and I think it's a little wide. Maybe it should be a little narrower. Do I still really like Mr. Morris's tie, or was I just being polite?
Well, Michael, do you feel like that's the response you're getting from the state?
Well, I think to defend the state for a minute, and yeah, I don't necessarily do it all the time, but here was a particular project where you're integrating for the first time multimodal transportation projects. You're doing it in a way that is multifunctional, meaning you're integrating more than just transportation into the same corridor. Water, utilities, you're dealing with all the way from reducing electric power rates to making sure 50 years from now we have enough drinking water, and I argue the rural interests need to get a seat at the table to do that. You're doing it in a way that is going to finance a project that has never been done before in the United States, which is bringing in the private sector. It's a common practice in other countries.
Third world. I might admit, I might just jump in and say that is a common practice in third world countries.
The governor
likes to say we have the fifth largest economy in the world, so I'm not quite sure why we're adopting third world financial planning.
I don't look at Europe as third world, but these particular elements are, in a very imaginative fashion, were crafted that, in my opinion, you couldn't have had a bottom-up approach to craft them. Whenever you develop a new spaceship, we're not critical of NASA that they developed a new revolutionary spaceship. Now, if TxDOT said, we're not going to hold any public meetings, we have all the right answers, we're not very flexible, then I think there is some point to the process.
You know, Let me just finish the point.
I'm a very believer in a bottom-up approach, but at some point, two things have to occur. The original idea has to be put on the table, of which it was, and if it's going to be a bottom-up approach, there has to be lots of opportunity to participate. Now, if the state of Texas is not interested in what the elected officials in our region say, or they don't listen to the comments that are made at public meetings, and they don't listen to you, Linda, or the rural interest, then I think you should stand up and say, this was a process that was rigged from the very beginning, that no one cares about anything. But I hope you would be the first person that if the state comes back and says, you know what, we don't have to put everybody in the same 1,200-foot quarter. We can build two or three parallel 400-foot quarters if they meet the same purpose. I'm back to my international mm-hmm. China competition. Mm-hmm. And we can tuck it into the Dallas-Fort Worth region if that helps with the transportation. And we won't build it in County X if County X doesn't want us to do it. And the 100 other issues. Then I hope Quarter Watch is the first one that stands up and says, you know what? It maybe had a bumpy start. They committed to have an open process. And if this open public involvement process, which, again, I'm proud that you're holding this show to get people to come out tomorrow, maybe the public can come out and, participate in this particular process. I have total confidence that the state of Texas is not going to walk away from this process and just unilaterally do what they intended to do in concept 3 years ago.
Well, and I appreciate that. And I do want to clarify, and I apologize for interrupting you. I'm a terrible interrupter, that these are NEPA hearings. Now, the only public hearing the TxDOT held was in 2004, and these are part of the environmental process. So the exchange of information is not there for the citizen. They come, they ask questions. There's very little information because it's very early in the environmental process. It's tier one. So the answers aren't there. Mr. Morse is in a unique position because in his role, he has a lot of interaction with decision makers and policy makers, and he has that benefit. And that is unique. Not every citizen in Texas has the opportunity to talk with Mr. Williamson at the chairman of the Transportation Commission and get his feedback on that approach. I'm comforted by the NCTCOG plan because I was really excited to see something that transportation planners had suggested. But I also want everybody to understand that in order to make the Trans-Texas Corridor work in the Metroplex, it was necessary to divide out all of its elements. And yet, as the plan was originally proposed, it was take the whole footprint as is.
You can find more information about this issue at quarterwatch.org, also at keeptexasmoving.org. My guests today were Linda Stahl, a founder of quarterwatch.org. Michael Morris is Director of Transportation for the North Central Texas Council of Governments. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Public hearings on the Trans-Texas Corridor are taking place around the state through August 10th. The last one scheduled for North Texas takes place tomorrow evening at Dallas's Grauweiler Community Center on Harry Hines. There's an open house that starts at 5, so you can ask questions. Public comment will be invited starting at 6:30. Jeff Whittington produces the talk show. Jeannie Mascoro is our engineer. It was Becky Madole screening phone calls today. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.